The new Marquette Law School survey released this afternoon gives us the latest on the opinions of Wisconsin voters.
The candidates on the Democratic side of the presidential ticket are separated by just 1 point, but Donald Trump is holding a decent-sized lead over his Republican counterparts.
The poll also looks at Wisconsinites' opinions on the state Supreme Court race, who they like between Senator Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, and more.
Joining us now to talk about the results of the survey, we have Charles Franklin with us. He's professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. And director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start with the Democratic side of the presidential race here in Wisconsin. Tightening up, it looks like. What do the new numbers tell us?
Yes, it's a dead heat at this point. Clinton at 43, but Sanders at 44, 1 point ahead. Now, the margin of error here is 6.9 points, so 1 point difference is very much inside the margin of error. But in January, it was Clinton 45, Sanders 43, also essentially a dead heat. But back in November, Clinton had a 9 point lead, 50 to 41. So we're seeing the tightening of that race from November to January stay very tight, and with Sanders taking just the very slightest of advantages now.
And do you think that follows on what's been going on nationwide with Sanders picking up some wins or close second places, Iowa, New Hampshire?
Well, certainly over the long haul, this is very much true, as Clinton had a 12-point lead last September. Our poll was conducted after Iowa and New Hampshire were done, but before Nevada was done. So the effects here are really from the first two events, one of which was essentially a tie, and the other, of course, Sanders won strongly. Sanders' performance here is driven by his appeal to independents and independents who lean to the Democratic Party and say they will vote in the Democratic primary. Clinton is especially strong among people who consider themselves strong Democratic identifiers.
Let's go to the Republican side. Donald Trump pulling ahead a little bit with the lead here from the previous survey. So what are we seeing on the Republican side?
Yeah, a little movement up for Trump. He was at 24% in January, now at 30%, so that's a 6-point increase for him. Rubio is now at 20, up 2 points from last month, and Cruz at 19, up 3 points from last month. So the poll is quite consistent in who the top three are, but is giving Trump a little bit more of an advantage in that race than he had a month ago.
Now, I got to ask you about favorability here. This is when you're not asking who you're going to vote for, but how do you view the candidate? People say favorable, unfavorable. To get the favorability rating, you subtract the bad from the good, as I understand it.
Yes.
So, all right, Donald Trump, his favorability rating comes out to zero among Republicans. Negative when you include everybody. So have we ever seen something like this? This is their front runner. He's viewed as the most likely candidate, a zero favorability rating in the party he's running in.
This reflects just how unusual this year's races are and how different they are from the normal. With Trump, that zero is coming from 45% of Republicans who view him favorably, but another 45% that view him unfavorably. In contrast, Ted Cruz is at positive 46 and Marco Rubio at positive 47. So this is really exceptional for a front runner to have the front runner status because they have a strong support within the party, even though they also have strong opposition within the party. And that's been the key to Trump so far, is enough supporters within the party and a fractured enough field that he has consistently been finishing in first place with votes and polls typically in the 30s, though he was in the high 40s in the Nevada contest on Tuesday night.
Staying with the presidential race for a bit, you also did head-to-head. So Clinton against Trump, Sanders against Rubio, the various permutations there. What struck you about what came out from that?
Well, we've been doing this for a while, and the thing that's striking is that Clinton is essentially tied with Cruz and Rubio. She's exactly tied with Cruz, 43-43, and has a 1 point edge on Rubio, 44-43. Against Trump, she leads by 10 points in the November election. But the contrast here is that Bernie Sanders does a good deal better against each of those Republicans. If Clinton has a 10-point lead over Trump, Sanders has a 20-point lead, 54-34. And Sanders has an 18-point lead over both Cruz and Rubio when it comes to the general election. So how can this be, given that they're essentially Clinton and Sanders are essentially tied within the party? It's coming from Sanders' strength with independent voters, who he wins over in substantial numbers in the general election, whereas Clinton has problems with those independent voters who have a net negative view of her, and that makes her a weaker candidate for November. Again, the striking point here is that as a front runner, you have weakness among independents in Clinton's case.
Talking to Charles Franklin right now about the new Marquette University Law School poll released just a little while ago today, looking at the opinions of voters from around the state.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you know who you'll be voting for in the April presidential primary here in Wisconsin? If not, what could a candidate do to win you over? How about the state Supreme Court race or the race between Senator Johnson and Russ Feingold? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up this discussion with Charles Franklin and look at some of those races here in the state in just a bit.
But first, I'm here with Michelle Good, and this is the Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Membership Drive. Our goal is to keep bringing you timely, important topics like discussions of this Marquette Law School poll that was just released today, looking at how Wisconsin voters are leaning. Earlier, we talked about the replacements for the Government Accountability Board, all very timely and important topics to your life in Wisconsin. Your support is what makes these conversations happen. So give now. Any amount makes a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you couldn't have a better time to make your pledge because we have a dollar-for-dollar match up to $2,500 in effect right now. It's a great time to pledge because Urban Land Interests in Madison will double every dollar that you give. It's their way of inspiring you to support WPR. Double the impact of your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, each and every morning, the Central Time team meets to look at the day's programming, to assess how we did the day before. We look for the balance of really timely, important political topics that are important for voters to know about, and then more fun things. We talked about the fishing expo earlier, or we talk about things that are happening in the general pop culture.
Snow sculpting yesterday.
A little bit of everything is the mix that we strive for, things that will both entertain and keep you educated and informed. You don't get a show like this anywhere else. And this show is possible, pledge by pledge, only on listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. So please give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Since we launched our Sustainer program, thousands of members have made the switch by providing a steady, reliable stream of support to WPR. They make monthly automatic gifts. That security comes with benefits, both for you and for us.
We can focus more of our resources on programming, and you don't have to remember to renew your membership each year because it automatically rolls over. Becoming a Sustainer today at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is a really great sign of how much you value the programming. And you can start with maybe $5 or $10 a month, whatever amount you choose.
WPR has been around for a long time. As a matter of fact, we are coming up on our 100-year anniversary.
That's amazing.
And that is because we are committed to quality. That quality is possible thanks to you. Listener donations make up the single largest piece of our budget.
Your contribution makes this program possible and so many others as well. You're part of the quality you hear every day on WPR when you donate at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Our dollar-for-dollar match is still in effect. We've got, I'm terrible at math. We've got a lot of money still out there.
$1,700 left.
Make that pledge right now. Take advantage. Your money goes twice as far when you give right now. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Your money will go twice as far when you make that pledge. And thank you.
You never know what you're going to get on the Joy Cardine Show weekday mornings from 6 to 9.
I'm a native of Wisconsin and annoyingly proud of this state. The rest of the world does not have great cheese. No one knows what a brat is.
On Monday morning, I know what I'm going to eat on Friday evening. My wife and I go out to fish fry as a matter of routine.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on the Joy Cardine Show.
On Point, to the best of our knowledge, Zorba Pastor on Your Health. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you. Support also comes from Dean and St. Mary's Cardiac Center, dedicated to delivering advanced heart treatment with compassion. We listen to more than just your heart. Details on services provided at deancare.com/cardiac.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're finding out what Wisconsin thinks of the candidates in the races for president, Senate, and state Supreme Court. And we want to hear from you.
Who do you like in any of those contests? Who are you voting for in a presidential primary in April, if they're still on the ballot by then? Call 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. Let's take a caller on presidential politics. We've got Matthew on the line in Milwaukee. Matthew, hi.
Hello. Good afternoon. Love the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks. What do you think?
Honestly, guys, don't judge me, but I voted Democrat for a president ever since I could vote. And I'm going to vote for Trump this election. And I'm getting, of course, as you can imagine, a lot of ridicule from my peers. However, to me, the only conclusion I can think of, and I just want your opinion on this, Professor, that the reason Trump is doing so well, do you think it's just because he's self-funded? He's not taking lobbyist money at all? To me, I kind of feel that's where my vote is going this year because of that fact.
Matthew, thanks a lot for that call. And Charles, it kind of reminds me of the argument that Herb Kohl made. Nobody's senator but yours. He had enough money to fund his own campaigns. And Donald Trump has kind of made that case, too. Hey, I could pay my own way here.
And it's something that he's repeatedly stressed. It's ironic that that's also an element of Bernie Sanders' argument that he's being funded by small contributors. This question of money in politics is something that voters give survey responses saying how much they distrust the impact of money in politics, but rarely do they get a chance to choose among candidates, one of whom at least is largely, if not completely, self-funding, as is Trump. But that question of interest group and special interest influence through money is something that supporters really within both parties find troubling. We just simply haven't seen it emerge as a major issue in a campaign in which the candidates really differed on that. Maybe this time we will.
Matthew, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Tony in Menominee Falls, bringing us to another race. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I'll be voting for Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
For the president, I'll be voting for Hillary Clinton. I think she's got the experience to lead the country. For the state Supreme Court justice, I'll be voting for Kloppenberg. And for U.S. Senate race, I'll be voting for Russ Feingold. I believe all those people bring the diversity of thought that we need for the country right now.
Tony, thanks for that call. Supporting the Democratic candidates, some of them, the candidate viewed as supported by liberals in that Supreme Court race. Let's go to that Supreme Court race now, Charles Franklin. What did you find out there? Close race there, too.
Very, very close. In fact, as close as it can get. Among all registered voters, Bradley 30%, Kloppenberg 30%, and a whopping 31% who say they don't know who they would vote for in that race. When we push it a little bit to look at people who say they're absolutely certain they'll vote in April, it's still a tie, 37% for Bradley, 36% for Kloppenberg, and a full 23% who say they don't know. So it seems very clear on this race that voters have a lot of minds to make up before they settle on it, but the two candidates start out as dead even as they could possibly be.
But court races, there tends to be a lot of people unfamiliar with these candidates. These are not household names. They rarely are.
And that is one major issue. The other is, because it's a nonpartisan election, voters don't have the cue of a party label, especially on the ballot on election day. And that means that it's harder for voters who only casually pay attention to politics to easily sort out who's the candidate that they might agree with the most. We will see, I predict, an enormous amount of advertising between now and April 5th on that race. We'll see how much voters develop opinions about the candidates and who in the end that advantages.
Want to check out a couple other races before we're done. The U.S. Senate race, Ron Johnson, Russ Feingold, numbers holding pretty steady there from your previous surveys.
Here the numbers are just rock steady. It was 49-37 Feingold over Johnson this time, but a month ago it was 50-37, and a month before that it was 49-38. These numbers just haven't moved all year. I think it reflects the fact that people approach the race with their views, but that the race really hasn't developed yet, and therefore there hasn't been much shifting of opinion. Who knows which direction it'll go as the race heats up over the summer and fall, but for the last year, this has been basically a 10-point race plus or minus a point or two.
There's been concern for the Johnson campaign over name recognition. A lot of people still not identifying him, despite being the sitting senator. Any new updates on that?
Yeah, he's still a bit less well-known than Feingold. There's a little bit more recognition of both him and Feingold compared to our January poll. But in January, both of their don't-know rates ticked up a little bit, as if people maybe took the Christmas and New Year's holidays and took a break from politics for a little bit.
And let's wrap up with a look at Governor Walker's approval numbers. They've been lower than they had been since his presidential campaign.
And we're not seeing much change there. He's at 39% approved, 55 disapproved now. Back in September, it was 37 approved, 59 disapproved. So there's been a gradual decline in disapprove by 4 points since September and a 2-point rise since September in approval. But I think this is largely to be expected. Approval ratings usually change slowly, and the question here is, can the governor win back the support that he's lost, and how long does it take? But the idea that these numbers would turn around in a very short period of time after he left the presidential race, I think clearly is not happening.
Charles, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Charles Franklin with Marquette University talking about the latest Marquette Law School survey released this afternoon. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Delegates are part of every presidential primary season, especially at the nominating convention for each party. Whoever brings in the most delegates wins the nomination.
But in this election cycle, the role of super delegates has been getting a lot of attention, especially on the Democratic side. Despite Bernie Sanders' win in the New Hampshire primary, Hillary Clinton walked away with as many delegates as he did because of super delegates who had already committed to her. That got us wondering, how does the delegate system work and who are the superdelegates?
Elaine K. Mark lectures in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's also a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at Brookings Institution. And she's the author of Primary Politics, How Presidential Candidates Have Shaped the Modern Nominating System. Elaine, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
So before we dive into talking about superdelegates, can you tell us how the delegate system works?
Well, it's pretty similar on both sides of the aisle for both parties. Usually there is a primary. Most states do have primaries. What the primary does is it doesn't elect the delegates themselves. It simply allocates the delegates, which is something not many people realize. So what, for instance, and each party has different rules for how you allocate the delegates, but basically the results of the primary tell you how many delegates each presidential candidate is entitled to. And then at some later date, usually, the party holds a separate meeting, a convention, a caucus, something like that, and the actual people are elected. But both parties now elect the delegates in accordance with the primary. So very few delegates are elected independently of the results of the primary.
So then we have the super delegates, and we'll talk about that on the Republican side just a little later. But in a recent New York Times opinion piece looking at the Democratic primaries, the editorial board called the Democratic super delegates the party bigwigs. So who are those bigwigs exactly?
Well, they are all the Democratic governors, all the Democratic senators, and all the Democratic members of the House of Representatives. A handful of other people, like living former presidents, so President Clinton gets a vote at the convention, and then the members of the Democratic National Committee. And that includes the state chairman and vice chairman from every state and the National Committee members. Now, the DNC is the group that actually puts on the nomination system. Give you an example, the Democratic Party of Iowa had to find 1,681 precinct caucus locations to hold the Iowa caucuses. They had to publicize that. They had to organize somebody to be there at every place. They had to organize the reporting, et cetera. It's a big, big job. It is better if the party chairman is kind of non-committed. And so as a reward, and it's not much of a reward, but as a reward, they get to go to the convention uncommitted. And the same thing for the Republican Party chairman and the Republican National Committee members. They are all superdelegates, if you will, to the Republican convention.
So the superdelegates are, you said, uncommitted. They're able to vote for the candidate the candidate that they feel would be the best nominee for the party, regardless of how their state goes?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. They are allowed, they're not, required to vote according to the results of the primary in their state. Now, that being said, there's a lot of, paranoia about this, but the superdelegates almost always vote according to how the public votes. Mm. Right? Why? Because guess what? They're all elected too. So it's very unusual that you're going to have somebody who's, going against the will of the people. The superdelegates have been in power since the 1984 convention. They have never overturned the will of the delegates elected through the primary system.
And the rest of those delegates, is it a winner-take-all where if someone wins a primary in a state, if a candidate wins that primary, they get all of the delegates, or is it proportional to how the votes go?
Well, in the Democratic Party, it's all proportional, okay? In the Republican Party, it's about half and half. So far, the delegates in the Republican Party, it's been mostly proportional. On Super Tuesday, it'll be mostly proportional. And then, according to the Republican rules, starting on March 15th, the delegates will be elected in a variety of ways, but more winner-take-all than proportional.
I think it's kind of no surprise that this whole system can be kind of mind-boggling to the non-political animal.
It is kind of mind-boggling, but, what I tell people is, you don't really have to worry about that. And the reason is, look, in the old days, we had to work out these formulas by hand when we got the votes in. These days, the people at the networks, the wonks who do the hard work at the networks, they have these wonderful newfangled things called computers, and there are many, many different allocation formulas, but frankly, they're plugged into computers. So as soon as the results, say the Republican primary results for the first congressional district in Alabama come in and are, there's enough of the vote in to see what the vote looks like, the formula is programmed in, and we know automatically, that means Donald Trump won two delegates, or that means that Hillary Clinton won three delegates, and so we don't really have to worry about it other than to know that early in the system on the Republican side, candidates can split up the vote because it's proportional. As the Republican contest goes on, there will be a fair number of states that are winner-take-all. And so whoever wins the state wins everything.
We're talking with Elaine Kmark. She's an adjunct lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's also a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at Brookings Institution and the director of the Center for Effective Public Management at Brookings. She wrote the book Primary Politics: How Presidential Candidates Have Shaped the Modern Nominating System. So going back to the Democratic side, because there's been a lot more talk of superdelegates and the role they might play on that side of the primaries. Out of the entire pool of delegates, what percentage have that superdelegate status?
On the Democratic side, it's about 14%. It varies a little bit because, you know, some years if the Democrats control the Congress, they've got more members. Some years they don't. And on the Republican side, it's smaller. It's about, I think it's about 4%.
And we've been hearing a lot about the role of superdelegates on the Democratic nomination because of the fact partly that it's a higher percentage, but also because there do seem to be some splits happening between Bernie Sanders doing very well in New Hampshire, winning that primary, but Hillary Clinton coming out with almost as many delegates because of those superdelegates that have declared for her. Republicans, as you said, also have superdelegates, but they've recently made a change to that system. What was that change?
To the superdelegate system?
For Republicans?
Yeah, what the Republicans changed was that they now allocate all their delegates according to the results of the primaries. That didn't used to be the case in the Republican Party. And so in Iowa, for instance, their convention delegates will have to reflect the division of preferences among those first-tier caucus goers that we saw. In terms of their superdelegates, it's simply the national committee people, and I don't think they bind them according to the results of the primary. Those people are, you know, there by virtue of their office.
Mm-hmm. And so let's go back to the Democrats. For a candidate to have a lock on the nomination by the time of the party's national convention, what do they have to have accomplished?
Well, they simply need a majority of delegates, right, going into the convention. The magical number for the Democrats is 2,408, I believe, is the magic number for the Democrats. And they need to have that number of delegates, and it needs to be, you know, confirmed. So what usually happens is that as the delegate count goes on, and as we move through the spring, 2,408 for the Democrats, 1,237 for the Republicans. Mm. As the contest goes on throughout the spring, the media usually keeps track of the delegates. For those delegates who get elected who are perhaps uncommitted, they will try to ask them, you know, what's your preference? Who do you think you might vote for? They'll do the same thing for the superdelegates. They'll poll them and then re-poll them and re-poll them because they can change their minds. And so that we'll see that. You'll see starting on March 1st, you'll see that the big result out of March 1st, the big story will be in each party, who won the most delegates. Now, the most interesting thing here to remember is that, by and large, there will be no people selected on March 1st to be delegates to the convention. It will only be that Donald Trump, for instance, will get X number of people once they elect them. But usually that takes place after the primaries. So that's a little confusing.
Right. So it's when those people come in as delegates, they will be told, you're voting for candidate X because they carried your state.
Well, I mean, what happens is that you can't, by and large, the presidential candidates have to approve the people who are running for delegates in their name.
Hmm.
So it's not that they're told, there will be a Donald Trump caucus or a Hillary Clinton caucus. And the campaigns generally have a lot to say about who runs as their delegates because they want people running who are genuinely supporters and who are not going to get there and change their mind.
So have there ever been any serious moves to change or eliminate the delegate system or at least the superdelegates?
Nope. After 2008, the Obama campaign, which was kind of in the same situation that the Sanders campaign finds themselves in today, they felt that they were doing really well, but that all the superdelegates were for Hillary. And after that, there was a movement to try and change it. And, of course, it failed because the people who have to change it are the members of the Democratic National Committee, and the members of the Democratic National Committee didn't find it very palatable to deprive themselves of votes at the convention. And they certainly weren't going to have a vote to give themselves votes and deprive their senators and their governors and their congressmen of votes at the convention. So that's why it didn't change, and that's why it probably won't change.
So just to wrap up, Elaine, if we asked you to look into your crystal ball, do you think the superdelegates are going to have any significant impact on the outcome of this year's election or the nominating process?
Most likely they will not. And the reason will be that in a two-way race, somebody is going to probably come up with a majority. The only way you have the superdelegates having an important impact is if the people don't decide. If the people don't decide, and that means that, for instance, the two candidates come in tied, or in the Republican instance, in the Republican case, nobody gets a first ballot majority, so then the superdelegates will be very important. But frankly, because the superdelegates are all elected officials, and have to go back and face the same voters that voted for the presidential candidates, by and large, they will follow the will of the people when push comes to shove. But it is always possible that the will of the people will be ambiguous or inconclusive, in which case then the superdelegates really matter.
Well, Elaine, thanks so much for explaining all of that for us.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
That was Elaine Kmark of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and the Brookings Institution. She's the author of Primary Politics, How Presidential Candidates Have Shaped the Modern Nominating System. And she joined us to explain the delegate system.